Welcome to the History News Network podcast edition. I'm David Austin Walsh, editor of the History News Network, and with me today to discuss Steven Spielberg's new movie Lincoln is Lewis P. Major, William R. Kennan Jr. Professor in American Institutions and Values at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut, where Professor Major teaches American cultural history and the history of the Civil War era. He's won a number of different awards over the course of his professional career, teaching awards from Harvard University and the City College of New York, fellowships from the Whiting Foundation, the National Endowment for the Humanities, and the Mellon Foundation, and is the author of numerous books on the Civil War and Abraham Lincoln, most recently Lincoln's 100 Days, the Emancipation Proclamation, and the War for the Union, out now by Harvard University Press. Professor Major is also the author of a recent article in the Chronicle of Higher Education, entitled Lincoln at the Movies, which is a cultural history of our 16th president's film appearances. In it, he highly praised Spielberg's new movie, Daniel Day-Lewis's performance as the president, writing that the actor summons Lincoln from the dead, and the contemporary political relevance of the film. Professor Major is joining me by phone. Professor, thank you for agreeing to speak with HNN today. First of all, Professor Major, here's the question that's on everybody's mind. How accurate is the movie Lincoln?
It's a great question, and of course, as with all these things, it depends on what we want from accuracy. The overarching tale, the tale that Lincoln involved himself in wrangling votes and applying pressure to get the 13th Amendment passed through the House, is absolutely true, as are some of the subplots in the film, his relationship with Mary Todd Lincoln and family concerns. The Hampton Roads Conference was indeed going on at the time. So in that sense, the film is very accurate to what was taking place. We can talk further at some point about some of the larger kind of interpretive issues. And then the more specific inaccuracies are sort of minor, but those are there as well, despite the fact that Spielberg devoted a tremendous amount of attention to trying to get things as historically accurate as possible.
And can you point out some of these inaccuracies? I know Harold Holzer wrote a very lengthy article in the Daily Beast recently, just doing just that. But what jumped out at you?
Well, you know, they're just some matters of sort of tone and detail. You know, there's a scene where Lincoln slaps his son in the face. It's highly unlikely, given what we know about Lincoln, that he ever would have used kind of, you know, physical punishment upon his children. There's an incident much earlier in his life where he sort of said he had spanked one of his sons and said he had regretted doing it. So that's just a moment that doesn't ring true. There are other details that, you know, for example, the posture of Lincoln's body on the bed in the scene that depicts after the assassination is not accurate based on the historical record as we know it. Things like Grant's dress when he comes out of the meeting at Appomattox Courthouse is not accurate. So those are the kinds of details that that may be troubling to some.
I have to admit, when I watched the Appomattox scene, I was struck by the fact that Grant was wearing his full dress uniform and was not spattered in mud.
Exactly. Again, but you know, to balance it on the other side, you know, Spielberg took every pain that he possibly could to recreate Lincoln's office as we know it to have looked, and I think it's remarkable in terms of, you know, down to the details of the desks and the wallpaper, even the books that were on the shelves. He went so far as to record the sound of Lincoln's pocket watch. He was given permission, I believe, by the Smithsonian to do so. And there's a stunning scene where, you know, Lincoln is sitting there with his pocket watch and we hear the ticking, and it's really astonishing to think that what we are hearing is something that Lincoln himself actually heard. So, you know, there's always a series of trade-offs in these kinds of things. You know, there's a tremendous attempt to be as factually accurate as possible, but then there are sort of missteps about the facts, and some of the larger matters are not so much about being factually inaccurate, it's just sort of interpretively being off the mark. So the opening scene in which black soldiers recite the Gettysburg Address, you know, is pretty absurd. I mean, we understand that that's not something that ever could have actually happened, as opposed to other scenes which are likely to have happened. But on the other hand, you know, this is a film, it's not a documentary, and Tony Kushner wrote a brilliant script that takes literary and poetic license where it needs to in order to sort of make a larger point about the war and emancipation.
So what you're saying seems to be that it's more important that the texture of the film is in a broad sense accurate. And
yes, for me it is. I think it's an incredible, riveting performance. I mean, everyone has said this. There's not much more to be said about Daniel Day-Lewis's evocation of Lincoln. The voice, the posture, the walk, it really is just remarkable.
Well, I think
anyone who's read Lincoln and studied Lincoln for a long period of time sort of feels they're in Lincoln's presence watching Day-Lewis act.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's true, but I do need to point out that there was an article. It was actually published slightly before the wide release of the film, but it was in the Daily Telegraph, which is a British newspaper, and it was all about how audiences did not find Daniel Day-Lewis believable as Lincoln, because he was not deep-voiced, because he was ungainly, because he did not conform to the myths, and we'll talk about this later with the sort of cinematic history of how Lincoln's been portrayed, but how the myth of Abraham Lincoln and how he's been portrayed in the past.
But that's exactly the point. So coming back to the point of historical accuracy, what is so marvelous about the portrayal is it does capture what we know of Lincoln from a historically accurate viewpoint. Yes, everyone wants to imagine Lincoln with the deep stentorian voice of a Henry Fonda or a Hal Holbrook. The fact of the matter is, contemporaries all said he had a sort of high-pitched, squeaky voice, almost a tenor, and Day-Lewis mirrors that. So in that sense, I think the film does great service in terms of challenging a certain iconic sense of Lincoln and making him a human being, allowing us to see him in his kind of storytelling, awkward best.
Mm-hmm. Is there something slightly uncanny about having an Anglo-Irishman like Daniel Day-Lewis portraying and to a certain extent deconstructing the myths we've built up around such a quintessential American icon?
Well, it's an amazing thing about Daniel Day-Lewis, because if you look at the roles that he's played, I mean, one can narrate a large chunk of American history just from the sort of historical roles, both fictional and real, that he's played, whether going back to Last of the Mohicans or Bill the Butcher in the Martin Scorsese film, The Gangs of New York, or other roles that he played in There Will Be Blood. So it's fascinating to think about how it is that he's drawn to these deeply historical roles and his ability to immerse himself and really bring out something about the period that seems really true and authentic to us.
Hmm. Well, stepping away from Lincoln, the modern film, and going back towards your article in the Chronicle of Higher Education, you wrote, which sort of served as a cinematic history of how Lincoln has been portrayed. And there was a question I wanted to ask you, because you briefly touched on it in the article, but you didn't go into an incredible amount of detail. Lincoln's first appearance on the silver screen was in D.W. Griffin's racist epic, Birth of a Nation. And how is this Lincoln portrayed compared to later on?
Yeah, I want to be clear that that's not the absolute first depiction of Lincoln. There are some even earlier shorts and silent films in which Lincoln is depicted, but that is the first one that I think is of major significance, certainly, if we're going to talk about the kind of arc of portrayals of Lincoln. And what we have in certainly those early depictions, and again, this is D.W. Griffith, and The Birth of a Nation is one of these classic movies that serves to offer an interpretation of Reconstruction that reigned for a long time. But Lincoln appears in part one, and he is not in any way the great emancipator, but he's the great reconciler. And this is part of a very common argument that was popular in the first part of the 20th century, the idea that, you know, the great tragedies of Lincoln's assassination is that he had real affection for the South, and that had he lived, the process of Reconstruction would have gone far more smoothly. D.W. Griffith picks that up again in a full-length biopic of Lincoln that he did in 1930. It's a talking picture, and that, again, is the sort of theme to the extent that we deal with the Civil War. There's almost no mention whatsoever about slavery or Lincoln's role as an emancipator. And that seems to be fairly common in film portrayals. What Spielberg's Lincoln does is in many ways overturn over a century of depictions of Lincoln that, for one reason or another, sort of shied away from the question of emancipation and slavery. It may be, and this comes back to a point of interpretation, that it almost goes too far, right? That it gives us Spielberg's Lincoln, gives us Lincoln as full-fledged, raging abolitionist in 1865, which he may well have been by then. But what Spielberg's film doesn't allow us to see is Lincoln's growth and evolution and transformation over time that gets him to that point.
Well, it should be noted that that was, I believe, a deliberate decision on Spielberg's part. There's the story is circulating that Tony Kushner, when he turned in his first draft, covered Lincoln's entire life, or at least his entire political life, or perhaps, and I might be getting my facts from, perhaps it was just the presidency, but it was a long, drawn-out epic of a film, and Spielberg said to him, well, the strongest part of this treatment is the last 3 months of his life, so let's just make a movie about that.
Which is fine, and we still end up with a very long film at 2.5 hours, but my point is it almost goes too far. If we're talking about the sort of interpretation that the film offers, it presents Lincoln as being far more abolitionist than in many ways that he was prior to that. There's an awkward scene in the movie where Daniel Day-Lewis has to explain why a 13th Amendment is needed because the Emancipation Proclamation didn't abolish slavery. I just think that, there might have been a sort of truer sense of Lincoln's evolution, which in and of itself is a very dramatic story that could have been incorporated into the movie. But it's fine that it's not there. It just can leave viewers with a mistaken impression about Lincoln's own dramatic set of transformations on the path from being anti-slavery, but then taking the action of the Emancipation Proclamation, and then moving forward toward the 13th Amendment.
Time permitting, we may come back to the to Lincoln's own arc here, but I wanted to talk briefly about Eric Foner's letter to the editor to the New York Times of, I believe, last week. He called the film's view of history, quote, severely truncated, going on to write that the 13th Amendment actually originated with Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, whom are not mentioned in Spielberg's movie. And in fact, I recently had somebody contact me on Twitter promoting their own film treatment for the true story of the origins of the 13th Amendment. In any event, Foner also wrote that the slaves were freeing themselves in the wake of Confederate military defeats by the winter of 1865, and none of this is mentioned in the movie. How do you respond to that?
Well, look, Foner's basic point is a terrific point, that it's about nuance in history. So, again, it's related to the point that I've been making, that you can't just begin the story of emancipation and abolition with these few months in 1865, because, as I said, it foreshortens and it curtails some of the complexity in the arc of that narrative. In the same way, the film overdoes the relationship between the debate over the 13th Amendment in the House and the Hampton Roads Peace Conference to make it suggest that there was a sort of choice here being made between peace and abolition. That's a false choice, and it seems clear that by January of 1865, there is not going to be peace without abolition. So, but for dramatic purposes, the film sort of elevates the Hampton Roads Conference to a place that it didn't really hold at the moment. The other arguments about who freed the slaves gets us into another set of discussions and issues, which I'd be happy to go into, as you know, because I've just written about the Emancipation Proclamation, and we're on the verge of celebrating the sesquicentennial of the signing of that decree.
What about Kate Masur's article in the New York Times from November 13th, where she criticized the film for having no fully fleshed African-American characters?
Well, I think it's a real disappointment about the film, that there's a missed opportunity there, and it wouldn't have been that difficult to take someone such as Frederick Douglass and to write him in as a character. You know, Douglass, who throughout the war pushed Lincoln and agitated for abolition, and who Lincoln, at the time of his second inaugural, treated very well and, in fact, met with him. So I think to have had some African-American characters who are more than just window dressers, missing, as in Elizabeth Keckley, would have added significantly to the film.
And please do go on about the Emancipation Proclamation, because part of the reason this conversation is so important is because, inevitably, this movie will be used in the classroom. It really is inevitable. And I think it's, personally, I think it will be very valuable in the classroom, but at the same time, there needs to be historians around to provide the proper context about what the film doesn't go into. So please, if you can give us I'm putting you on the spot here, but the sort of five-minute version of...
Let me just put it this way. I mean, to just focus on the 13th Amendment without focusing on the long history that gets to that point is to miss, in some ways, the most dramatic and significant elements of the story. Lincoln himself understood that a 13th Amendment was necessary in part because of the limitations of the Emancipation Proclamation. Now, the Emancipation Proclamation did indeed free slaves. This is a whole other shift in historiography where Lincoln went from being the great emancipator to falling into somewhat obscurity for a variety of different reasons, particularly in the post-civil rights era as people began to look at different elements of the Civil War. In some ways, I think we've lost the significance and the momentousness of the Emancipation Proclamation, and now is a good time to try and recover that. Unfortunately, the film doesn't allow us to do that, but Lincoln issues that decree, and the decree that he issues on January 1st is a very different one than the one that 3 months earlier he said he was going to issue. It's more radical, it's more extreme. He abandons colonization, he authorizes the enlistment of black troops. So those black troops we see at the beginning of Spielberg's Lincoln are there because the Emancipation Proclamation authorized their enlistment, and ultimately the story and the film Glory, of course, is a great Civil War movie that tells part of that story of those 179,000 African-American troops is critical not only to winning the war, but also to arguments for citizenship rights after the war. So the Emancipation Proclamation is a signal achievement. I mean, Frederick Douglass at the time proclaims, July 4th was great, January 1st is greater, and it is seen in the light of the Declaration of Independence. Without understanding that story, and then the story that goes from 1863 to 1865, particularly as Lincoln began to fear what would happen if he loses the election of 1864, and that's a very real possibility. Will the Emancipation Proclamation hold up? Will it be retracted? Will it be found unconstitutional? So there's a long... important story here about, yes, Lincoln freed many slaves, but freeing slaves is not the same as abolishing slavery. And at the same time, there's the ongoing problem of the existence of slavery in those four border states, Delaware, Maryland, Missouri, and Kentucky. So there's a longer story here, and it's a story from looking at it from Lincoln of his own evolution, his own growth, his own radicalization with respect to his understanding of how to go about abolishing slavery and the significance of doing so.
Well, and I think that part of that is actually in a very oblique way referenced in the movie when there's this scene, and it's been written about very favorably, and I enjoyed it, where he gives a legalistic argument, Daniel Day-Lewis as Lincoln, gives a legalistic argument against the Emancipation Proclamation to explain why it's necessary to move ahead with the 13th Amendment.
Yeah, but as I sort of alluded, I agree, but I think historians get that. I'm not sure to what extent the everyday viewer understands how the argument, the way it's presented in the film. But yeah, there is some attempt, because there has to be an attempt to sort of explain that, explain why a constitutional amendment went further than the Emancipation Proclamation. But this is not to say that the Emancipation Proclamation itself did not matter, did not free the slaves, was not one of the most radical acts in many ways in the history of U.S. government and politics.
This has been a production of the History News Network.
Yes, we'll rally round the flag, boys, we'll rally once again, shouting the battle cry of freedom. We will rally from the hillside, we'll gather from the plain.